Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Joshua Rubinstein of Amnesty International USA, who discusses his group's concern about the conditions under which hundreds of immigrants have been detained by federal authorities since the September 11th terrorist attacks. Investigative journalist Al Giordano, who takes a critical look at the Bush administration's plan for deeper involvement in Colombia's four-decade-long civil war. And Wangari Maathai, founder of Kenya's Greenbelt Movement, who explains how her grassroots campaign has protected the environment while empowering women and poor communities. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In a disputed election, Zimbabwe's President Robert Mugabe won a new six-year term over protests of the opposition Movement for Democratic Change and international election observers. Mugabe, who has been president for 22 years, claimed 55% of the popular vote, even though many voters never got a chance to cast ballots. According to the news magazine In These Times, this is a political story repeated across sub-Saharan Africa over the last year. Both Zambia and Uganda held disputed elections, with opposition parties charging the ruling party with harassment and interference in the democratic process. Ugandan opposition leader Akwil Rabwani complained that President Museveni, who took power in a 1986 military coup, unleashed the military in the days leading up to the March 2001 election and jailed and tortured much of the opposition. Museveni won 69% of the vote, and Rabwani, the opposition leader, fled into exile. Critics point out the double standards of Western nations like the United States and Britain, which embrace Museveni while vilifying Mugabe. Leading Nigerian journalist Abiba Don Pedro feels the push for new elections is just creating more strife, not because democracies are inherently weak, but because of the problems they inherit. The legacies of dictatorships are so great. In early March, Eric Schaefer, head of the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency's Enforcement Division, left his post in protest of the Bush administration's environmental budget, which is slated to cut 200 enforcement jobs at the EPA. In his resignation letter to agency administrator Christine Whitman, Schaefer stated these jobs were critical in building cases against big corporate polluters. And now, environmental regulators are proposing voluntary cooperation by utilities to clean up outdated coal-fired power plants which are emitting dangerous amounts of pollution. Over the past 3 years, Schaefer filed lawsuits under the 1970 Clean Air Act against 50 coal-powered plants that by themselves are responsible for 25% of all sulfur dioxide emissions into the air. According to a study by the Clean Air Task Force, sulfur dioxide pollution contributes to premature deaths from respiratory and cardiac problems and increasing cases of childhood asthma. In December 2000, the EPA announced a series of settlements with three power companies, Virginia Electric Power, Synergy, and Tampa Electric, when all agreed to install costly state-of-the-art anti-pollution equipment. However, according to The Nation magazine, under Dick Cheney's energy plan, kept secret by the White House refusing to release the guest list and agenda, Virginia Electric and Synergy reversed their previous decision and walked away from the deal. Gregory Whetstone of the National Resources Defense Council warned, "The signal here is that the cop is off the beat." Commercial salmon farms were once seen as the savior for British Columbia's Broughton Archipelago of scenic islands, 250 miles north of Vancouver. People were promised that it would be an eco-friendly industry, create new jobs, and ease the pressure on wild stocks of Pacific salmon. According to Mother Jones magazine, fish farms have turned out to be a calamity. Wild stocks of salmon were killed off, and dead fish and waste have polluted the waters. Big agriculture companies have introduced the profitable Atlantic salmon, which escaped from fish pens and took over the habitat of the native coho and Chinook salmon. In 1995, BC environmentalists instituted a moratorium on new fish farm sites. The farm owners responded by stuffing more fish into the existing 87 salmon farms, and in 1999, they grossed $292 million in farmed fish, 11 times the value of Canada's wild salmon catch. Modern fish farming started in Norway during the 1960s, as native stocks of salmon imploded due to overfishing and acid rain. The farm salmon proved very popular with pricey European restaurants, and big fish farms spread to British Columbia, Chile, Scotland, New Brunswick, and Maine. Deadly disease has followed corporate salmon farms. In the 1990s, infectious salmon anemia, similar to foot-and-mouth disease in cattle, spread through fish farms in Scotland and New Brunswick. To control the outbreak, Canadian officials ordered the killing of 1.2 million farm salmon. Last spring, a similar outbreak occurred in fish farms off the coast of Maine, and several salmon farms have since been forced to close. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.
In the weeks after the September the 11th terrorist attacks, some 1,200 immigrants were arrested or detained by the U.S. Immigration and Naturalization Service in a search for individuals connected to the deadly assaults on New York City and Washington, D.C. Although nearly all of those picked up were guilty of nothing more than minor visa violations, 6 months later, 300 non-citizens are believed to be still in federal custody, with an unknown number having been deported or released on bond. A report recently released by Amnesty International accuses the government of depriving a significant number of these detainees of their basic human rights under U.S. and international law. Amnesty states that many of those detained have been arbitrarily imprisoned in secrecy without access to an attorney or contact with family members. The human rights group has also expressed concern about the punitive conditions under which these individuals have been held, including prolonged periods of solitary confinement and heavy shackling. Amnesty has filed a lawsuit under the Freedom of Information Act demanding that the government release detailed information on those being held and is calling for an investigation of the conditions these individuals have been subjected to. Between the Lines' Scott Harris spoke with Joshua Rubenstein, Northeast Regional Director with Amnesty International USA, who questions the government's justification for withholding basic human and civil rights from these persons.
After September 11th, of course, it was natural the government had two things on its mind. First, to prevent another attack, and that was an immediate concern we all shared. And secondly, to uncover the full conspiracy that led to the attack in the first place. And this put people of Muslim background and people from the Middle East and Southeast Asia, countries like Pakistan and Bangladesh, in particular, it gave them particular vulnerability. So as many as 1,200 were taken into custody. We believe that around 300 remain in custody today. And their status is really very vague. The government says, well, they had violations of their visas. But, you know, for the most part, rarely do we take people into custody who have overstayed their visas. And we certainly don't put them in the extraordinary security circumstances that these detainees face now, where they cannot see their families except on a very irregular basis, where they're shackled, even shackled when they come before a judge. We have a case where someone was shackled while he was in the hospital having an infection treated. So these are very worrisome things.
What does international law tell us about the rights of detainees held under these circumstances in terms of their right to see a lawyer and in terms of right to see family members or know the charges lodged against them?
Well, I think what's more important is what U.S. law requires. U.S. law requires that within, I believe it's 24 hours or 48 hours typically, you have charges laid against you. You're taken before a magistrate of some kind. You have a lawyer attached to your case. That's what happens to, say, a petty criminal is picked up on the street. They're brought before a magistrate the next day. There's a lawyer assigned to them, say, from legal aid or somewhere. They're not just left there hanging by themselves. That's been a legal principle now for more than 40 years in the famous Gideon case. So this is very worrisome that somehow in the wake of September 11th, we feel it necessary to compromise these fundamental constitutional principles. And I have to say, while you know we all felt very shaken by the event, by the attacks on September 11th, no one suspended the Bill of Rights. And so many months have passed, and there seems no adequate explanation for why these people continue to be held. After all, the government had hard evidence that they were part of the conspiracy surrounding the attacks on September 11th, no doubt they would be charged. just as Mr. Massawi has been charged and will be tried in federal district court. That's being handled in a perfectly straightforward and legal way. He has adequate counsel. In fact, I'm sure he has very vigorous counsel. And that's the best way we know to make sure the evidence holds up.
Has Amnesty International and other human rights groups challenged the Bush administration's dealings with these detainees and their lack of rights accorded under U.S. law?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, first, we issued this report last week. We joined the lawsuit with other organizations under the Freedom of Information Act to gain the names of these detainees. After all, in the United States, it's certainly rare for someone to be arrested and held in a state jail or a county jail or a federal facility and not be allowed to know their names. That rarely, if ever, happens. And here it's happening in a prolonged way, and it's affecting hundreds of people. So we intend to challenge that. And secondly, by issuing this report, having a press conference, we're bringing it to the attention of the wider public, to members of Congress, and asking them to step in and raise questions. You know, one thing on top of the other does exert pressure on the administration to act, we feel, in a more proper way.
Would you comment for us on the idea that the Bill of Rights during a time such as we're going through now is somehow optional? I've heard government officials from the Bush administration use the phrase the Bill of Rights is not a suicide pact.
Yes, of course, the Bill of Rights is not a suicide pact, but it's one thing to give the government a certain amount of slack in the days and weeks after the attacks when we didn't know who these people were, we didn't know if there was a broader conspiracy or if there was going to be and another attack in the immediate future. But here we are more than half a year after the attacks. People have been held for 3 to 4 months in secret without access to attorneys, with irregular contact with their families. The government has not connected any of them, as far as we know, to the conspiracy on September 11th. And at this point, I think they're really flouting their power, not their authority under law, but their simple power. And that's very worrisome. The Bill of Rights was not suspended, and I don't think we should feel we need to suspend these fundamental values in the wake of a crisis. I think we look to these values to help guide us through a crisis. Now, to its credit, the president and state and local officials have been very mindful of the tragedy that occurred during World War II when we, in fact, did round up hundreds of thousands of Japanese Americans after the attack on Pearl Harbor. And so everyone's bending over backwards to make clear that in spite of the fact that these 19 nationals were from the Middle East, they were Muslims, most of them citizens of Saudi Arabia, that our counterattack and the war on terrorism is not directed at Islam or Muslims in general, and that's fine. But nonetheless, that's no excuse. That doesn't give, therefore, the government the power to go ahead and hold individuals, hundreds of them, without proper charges, without adequate contact with attorneys. Because that's just not how our system is supposed to work.
That was Joshua Rubinstein, Northeast Regional Director with Amnesty International USA. Contact Amnesty by calling area code 617-623-0202 or visit its website at www.amnestyusa.org. According to news reports, the Bush administration is laying the groundwork to escalate significantly U.S. involvement in Colombia's civil war. The White House is asking Congress to lift all restrictions currently in place on U.S. military aid to Colombia's government. Among the conditions that President Bush wants removed are limits which confine U.S. assistance to counter-narcotics operations, requiring Colombia's army to abide by human rights standards, and a cap on the number of U.S. military personnel allowed in the country. Congress allocated $1.3 billion to Colombia to fight the war on drugs in early 2000. After the September the 11th attacks on New York and Washington, the Bush administration has consistently labeled Colombia's largest leftist rebel group, the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, known as FARC, as a dangerous terrorist organization, generating increased support in Congress for an escalation of U.S. involvement. Since Colombia's President Andrés Pastrana broke off talks with FARC in February, the conflict has intensified between the guerrilla group, army, and right-wing paramilitary units, all accused of gross human rights abuses and participation in the drug trade. Between the Lines' Scott Harris spoke with investigative journalist Al Giordano, publisher of the online magazine Narco News, who takes a critical look at the Bush administration's plan for deeper involvement in Colombia's four-decade-long civil war.
Colombia is a country of 40 million people, the great majority of whom live in abject poverty. It's a country very rich in natural resources. It has a lot of oil. It has a lot of coal. It has a lot of precious minerals. It has agricultural products. And it has a very hardworking, decent people as a labor force. Throughout the last 40 years and more, working people and poor farmers in Colombia have tried to organize unions. They've tried to organize farmers' organizations. They've tried to negotiate for a fairer price for their labor and for their product, and to make sure that the profits for their oil and their coal and their natural resources remain in Colombia. There's also an oligarchy in Colombia made up of about 100 families that have controlled all these resources for so many years. And the problem is that when the Colombian people have tried to organize democratically, fair and square, the American way, by running for election, by organizing unions, by things we take for granted in the United States, the leaders are assassinated. Hundreds of union organizers are assassinated each year. Last year, there were 150 assassinated. There was once a political party called the Patriotic Union that had more than 300 of its candidates assassinated during one election campaign by the oligarchy and their military and their police and their paramilitaries. What Plan Colombia is about is preventing democracy from occurring in Colombia, and it forces the population of the majority of poor Colombians to turn to armed guerrilla organizations because the peaceful paths are closed.
Al Giordano, the Bush administration, as reported by the Latin American Working Group out of Washington, is preparing to ask for more funds, more money, under the guise of the fight against terrorism to supply the Colombian military with more training and more armaments. What, in your view, is the likely outcome of further and increased U.S. involvement in the conflict in Colombia?
Well, they're making a bad situation worse. They're polarizing the country. We just saw in the recent elections for Congress that the two traditional political parties, the Conservative Party and the Liberal Party, who've always held the center in Colombia, have lost the majority in both the House and the Senate to small parties, both from the far right and from the far left. Colombia is drifting every day deeper and deeper into civil war. This, I think, is what Washington wants. Washington prefers this, albeit that it causes so much misery and suffering unnecessarily, to democracy breaking out or democracy being allowed, because the democratic will of impoverished Latin American peoples is not always going to agree with U.S. policy on how to treat the United States oil companies, for example.
Al, I wondered if you would comment for us on the prospects for any kind of peace negotiations since the breakoff of negotiations between the government of Andres Pastrana and the FARC guerrilla movement.
There's no real hope for a negotiated peace right now. In fact, the cancellation of the negotiations in February was planned in December when Pastrana sent his aides to Washington, D.C. to meet with officials in Washington, and they decided, according to an article in El Espectador, one of the major media dailies in Colombia, they decided back in December that they would look for a pretext, look for an excuse to break off the peace talks, which they did in February. Now, what happened between December and February? There came the Super Bowl on February 3rd, when the United States government spent $1.5 billion, or part of its $1.5 billion PR budget in the war on drugs. They spent, I think, $3 million on that one day, on that one Super Bowl, to put ads on TV somehow blaming the Colombian rebels for the terror in Afghanistan when there's no connection. They did that having decided in December that they were going to try to move American public opinion to support a dirty war in Colombia. It's very similar to the tactics used to justify the Vietnam War, and it's going to have a similar result.
That was investigative journalist Al Giordano. His online magazine, Narco News, can be found on the internet at www.narconews.com. For decades, Kenya, a land of incredible beauty and abundant natural resources, has suffered the effects of several interrelated catastrophes. The introduction across much of the land of monocultured coffee production for export forced small farmers in search of firewood and building materials to denude the lush countryside of trees. This environmental devastation, combined with rampant political corruption and the imposition of harsh conditions laid down by international lending agencies, have created a disastrous situation for the people of Kenya. In 1978, a Kenyan woman named Wangari Maathai suggested the planting of trees as a way to assist rural women survive in these difficult circumstances. Thus was born the Green Belt Movement, one of the most successful grassroots women's empowerment campaigns in the world. Maathai has gained international recognition for her work, as well as the enmity of the Kenyan president, Daniel Arap Moi, who has been in office since she founded the Green Belt Movement. Maathai is teaching this semester at Yale University's School of Forestry and Environmental Studies, which is where, between the lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with her about the situation in Kenya that gave rise to her organizing effort and what the movement has accomplished so far.
This is a grassroots environmental organization or movement which is community-based and which is mostly driven by women in the rural areas. But it is beginning to also get into the urban centers where it is mostly concerned about open green spaces, protection of such spaces to ensure that they are available and the public have access to them. Now, when I first started in 1977, I was inspired by rural women who would attend meetings organized by the National Council of Women of Kenya. These women would often say that their concerns were lack of firewood, lack of building and fencing materials, fodder for their animals, and also food for household consumption. I was at that time teaching at the University of Nairobi. I quickly felt that maybe that was just one of these inspirations that sometimes hit us, that I thought, well, why not plant trees? And I decided to encourage the women that we could establish tree planting by first asking foresters to give us trees, but eventually we had to educate and train women so that they would establish their own tree nurseries and they would become completely independent in the production of trees. It is a movement that was initiated to meet the felt needs of local communities, that we respond to the needs of communities. We don't come with the preconceived ideas as to what communities need. We respond to what they say is their need. And of course, we are local, so it is very easy for us to identify this with the local communities and then empower them. And that's a very important word, empower them, so that they can do this for themselves rather than wait for the officials, the government, the aid agencies to come and do things for them.
The Green Belt Movement is responsible for planting millions of trees. Maybe you can update us on that. And what result has it had in the lives of these rural women?
Indeed, we have moved from the tree planting campaign onto other issues, such as at the moment we have civic and environmental education, which is a very important component of the tree planting, where we try to educate communities so that they can be empowered and they can take the responsibility of managing their environment responsibly instead of allowing it to degrade just because the government is not there to do it for them. This has given rise to advocacy, where we sometimes have to express our strong opinion about how some of the natural resources are managed by the government, and in particular, forests. And some of you may have heard about our getting into trouble with the law, being arrested, being thrown into jail. It is usually because of this advocacy where we are trying to say that we have a right to a healthy environment. And therefore, if a person is destroying forests, and especially forests in watershed areas, then obviously such a person is interfering with your capacity to have a good quality environment. And so we say this is a violation of our environmental rights. In the course of those 25 years, wonderful things have happened, and they're some of the ones that really give reason for us to have hope and to never give up, no matter how difficult sometimes these issues are and how frustrating sometimes it can be in working in our part of the world. The women have been able to plant over 20 million trees on their lands, and in some areas the land has been completely transformed, and some of the women have had aspects of their life completely transformed. For example, they can give themselves firewood. They do not have to walk long distances to fetch for firewood. And for women who have done this in their lives, or women who had to save cash to buy firewood to cook with, or women who had to stop their children going to school, especially girls, so that they can go and collect firewood. For these women to be able to have firewood right there next to their household, it is quite a revolution in their lives. The other thing is, of course, the beauty of the countryside, the fact that other animals return, that there is an increase in biological diversity in the woods, and the fact that some of these trees can be used as fodder for the animals. Some of these trees are fruit trees, so they improve the diets, and of course they protect the soil. That was one of the major concerns for us at the beginning, is to stop soil erosion.
That was Wangari Maathai, founder of Kenya's Greenbelt Movement. For more information, visit the Yale University website at www.yale.edu/forestry. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced by WPKN Radio's Public Affairs and News Departments. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a cassette copy of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756, or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Denise Manzari, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Nigel Rees.